From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Waylon Jennings, one of the creators of country music's outlaw movement. In the mid-70s, he made records with a stripped-down production style and a rock rhythm. It was called an outlaw movement, but it changed the direction of country music. Jennings has a new autobiography and a new CD. And our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been observing the presidential campaign, and he has some thoughts on the changing meaning of the word rich. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole and his running mate Jack Kemp meet today in San Diego for a joint rally. Dole will remain in California through Wednesday night's second debate with President Clinton. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bob Dole hopes to make up for what members of his own party describe as a lackluster performance in the first debate. Kemp is already stepping up his attacks on the president after being criticized for being too soft during his debate with the vice president. In appearances over the weekend, Kemp accused the president of an arrogance of power, avoidance of responsibility, and a habit of half-truths. Kemp and Dole have been advised to center the campaign on trust so that it becomes a referendum on President Clinton's character. Last week and over the weekend, both men used tougher language, with Dole calling Clinton the great exaggerator and Kemp bringing up issues such as the Whitewater land deal and misuse of FBI files. Dole and Kemp will hold a joint rally later today before Dole goes into seclusion to prepare for Wednesday night's debate. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Irvine, California.
Agribusiness giant Archer Daniels Midland will plead guilty to two federal counts of price fixing. The company will also pay $100 million in fines. ADM says the plea will end all of its Justice Department investigations of misconduct. The company has been probed for the last 4 years. The guilty pleas will be for the price-fixing sales of two products derived from corn. They are lysine, a feed supplement for livestock, and citric acid used in soft drinks and detergents. A Kurdish faction in northern Iraq says it has managed to stop its rivals from advancing on the regional capital of Erbil. The Kurdistan Democratic Party released a statement saying it had repulsed an offensive by the Puk west of Sulaymaniyah. The United States has warned that Iran and Iraq have no useful role to play in the conflict, the BBC's Chris Nuttall reports.
The PUK continued its advance along the road to the regional capital of Erbil this morning. A spokesman at the UN Coordinator's office in Baghdad confirmed reports that it had taken the town of Koizinjak and said there was now fighting around Degala, the last major junction before Erbil. The PUK has now recaptured much of the territory it lost during a 10-day rout in September when its fighters were driven back into the mountains or across the border to Iran. Its leader, Jalal Talabani, has said there will be no attempt to retake Erbil because he says it is still ringed by the Iraqi tanks that helped the KDP to capture it at the end of August. There are Iraqi forces near Erbil, but this may not discourage the PUK from an assault.
Chris Nuttall reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 44 points at 6,013. Trading is light. The Nasdaq is up 6.5 points. This is NPR. Irish police report they've arrested three suspected members of the Irish Republican Army. These arrests come a week after the IRA bombed the British Army's headquarters in Northern Ireland. It's not known if the men detained today are linked to that attack. They're being questioned about any ties to the group. Ireland's anti-terrorist legislation permits police to hold a suspect for up to 48 hours without charge. The Scottish government learns the results of an inquiry today into the murder of 16 school children and their teacher earlier this year. The inquiry was set up to review Scotland's gun control legislation. The government has promised to act on the inquiry's recommendations and make any necessary changes to the law. The BBC's Grant Ferret reports.
The inquiry took evidence from 170 witnesses during its investigation into how Thomas Hamilton was able to enter the school gymnasium in Dunblane and shoot dead 16 children and their teacher with legally held handguns. Such is the sensitivity of the subject that Lord Cullen delayed presenting his report to the government by several weeks in order to avoid any clash with the political party conference season. In the 7 months since the killings, there have been increasing calls for a complete ban on the private ownership and possession of handguns. A petition with more than 700,000 signatures has been handed to the government demanding such a ban, and the main opposition Labour Party has expressed its support. The government has refused to comment until it's seen Lord Cullen's recommendations.
Grant Ferrett reporting. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak met with Israeli President Ezer Weizmann today. They discussed the stalled Mideast peace talks. Mubarak says Weizmann told him Israel will keep its agreements with the Palestinians. Weizmann went to Cairo despite Israeli criticism he's overstepping the powers of his mostly ceremonial office, but Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says he hopes the visit will strengthen relations between Egypt and Israel. This is NPR.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Waylon Jennings started his career playing with Buddy Holly and went on to change the sound of country music as a creator of the so-called outlaw movement. Along with Willie Nelson, he originated a sound with less strings, more rock rhythms, and no sequence. Being an outlaw was a very rewarding experience. Waylon Jennings has had 16 number one singles and several gold and platinum albums. He's also performed with Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, and Willie Nelson as the group The Highwaymen. Now he has a new autobiography called Waylon. It's co-written with Lenny Kaye, Patti Smith's longtime guitarist. Jennings also has a new CD called Waylon, Right for the Time. From it, here's a song he co-wrote called The Most Sensible Thing.
I've taken chances on everything in my life. Even against all the odds, I've rolled the dice. Count me in on any deal that comes around. Right or wrong, never slow me down.
Waylon Jennings, welcome to Fresh Air. In your book, you said that Buddy Holly was the first person who had confidence in you, the one who gave you your first real break. He produced your first 45. How did you first meet Buddy Holly?
The first time that I can recall ever meeting Buddy was at a place called, a station called KDAV, which really was the first country music station in the world, full-time. And on Sunday afternoon, they had a program, started about 1 o'clock and went into 6 o'clock. It was called the Sunday Party, and local acts got to come in and sing, and Buddy was one of the regulars, and I was up there several times. I was from another town, about 40 miles away, Littlefield. But that's where I first got to know him, and we just kind of liked each other, you know. And we both love music, and that's about all we want to even talk about or think about.
Now, at some point, Buddy Holly gave you a bass, told you to learn to play it and to come on his tour. And that's how you nearly ended up on the plane that crashed, killing Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper. What's the story of how you were supposed to be on the plane and ended up not being on it?
Well, we were backstage in Clear Lake, Iowa. We had been on a bus, a school bus converted, because a couple of days before our regular bus had just, it was about 40 below and it froze up going right down the road. Anyway, the bopper, Big Bopper, had the flu, and he came to me and he says, I hear you got a plane tonight. And he said, is there any way I could talk you into letting me have your seat on that plane? And I said, if you talk to Buddy, if it's okay with him, it's okay with me.
And how did you find out what happened to the plane?
Well, the next morning we got there at the hotel in Moorhead, Minnesota. Anyway, we were on the bus and I had just woke up. And the tour manager came to the door and said, Waylon, come here. I want to talk to you. And I don't know what it was. I just kind of had a feeling. And I said, no, you go, Tommy. It was Tommy Alsop who played guitar. Because I don't know, I just had a feeling something was wrong. And sure enough, he came back and said that said the boys didn't make it. And that was my first experience of dealing with death of someone that was close to me. And it took me quite a while to get over it.
Did you end up feeling more vulnerable or more invulnerable knowing that you were almost on there and you weren't, therefore you survived?
Let me tell you, I'll be honest with you, I didn't know what to think. And then from that point on, we got to seeing some bad people, seeing that people could be bad, you know, and like, I'd never seen people like that who would talk you into something, lie to you to get their way, do anything they could to get their money, try to beat you out of your money. And I'd never been exposed to that in my life, you know, that kind of people. And as far as vulnerable, I felt guilty. That was my big problem. And then I felt disappointed and downhearted, and I just really felt disappointed in the world. It wasn't like I thought it was. I mean, here we are the night of that we got there, that morning, after they had lost their lives in that plane. And these people are begging us to go ahead and do the show, just begging us. And New York's begging us, and that if you'll just stay, we'll fly you home for the funeral, and you can come back, and we'll pay you really well, and then just finish out the tour, you know, because it'll just bankrupt us if you don't do that. And this kept begging, and so the very first night there in Moorhead, they had begged us to stay, like I say. And we played, and none of us, you know, you can imagine, we didn't want to play guitars or anything. We were in shock. And we got on the bus afterwards, and here come the road manager. And he said, they won't pay us. They want to dock us for Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and the Big Popper. And but some old country boy come out of us and say, tell them to either pay us or we're going to tear that building completely up. But...
And, it's so outrageous. The people,
it is. And then they never gave us any money from New York, and they had promised to fly us home for the funerals and everything, and they never gave us even just enough money to eat on where we wouldn't go home and couldn't go home until after the funerals.
Waylon Jennings is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography. Did you have a sense as a young man of what your own music was?
Now, you know, no. I didn't. I was just like everybody else. I heard somebody I liked. I loved Hank Williams. I loved Carl Smith and Ernest Tubb. And I wanted to sound like all of them. And I was in Phoenix and in a club before I really realized that I was different and that no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't imitate nobody.
What made you realize that at this club?
Well, the thing was... I was writing songs, and they sounded different. They sounded, you know, I thought, man, mine don't sound like anybody else's, you know, which I didn't realize was good. You know, I thought, but you couldn't imagine it being played on radio because I would use calypso beats and hard rhythms and what have you, and they wouldn't have fit at all in on the radio in country music that way. But the way I developed my style really was getting bored. I would be in a nightclub and play for 4 hours, and you sing the song like somebody the guy that wrote it or the guy that sang it. And I got tired of that, so I started changing the rhythms and maybe giving it a heavier beat and just rearranging the song to fit what I felt, and it worked.
In your book, you write that country music was looked down on when you were growing up. It was the music of the have-nots. How did that affect your feelings about country music?
Well, I loved it. I didn't care what they thought of it. And it was kind of, I think a lot of people liked it. They just drove down the street, and if they saw somebody they knew, they'd roll up the window where they couldn't hear. But I was never ashamed of liking country music. I'll tell you a good thing that happened to me. I worked in radio at a very young age. I was about 14 when I had my own radio show. And I sang on radio when I was about 12. Can you imagine that yodel? But anyway, they had block programming on this radio station, which would be 15 minutes of jazz, 15 minutes of country and western, 15 minutes of polkas. And I really learned to like all kinds of music, which helped me a lot.
I love your descriptions of those radio shows in your book. You describe going on location to local grocery stores, and you'd sing a few songs yeah. and interview the store's owner. Kind of different from
yeah,
radio.
Yeah, named George Sewell's Meat Market. Well, that was up on the hill, and it was Morris Fruit and Vegetable Market right down the street. And we'd do those live broadcasts, and sometimes they'd get a little out of hand.
How so?
Well, we'd slip and cuss or something like that. And there were some, old farmers. You'd go up and say, well, what do you think about this? And you'd say, oh, hell, I don't know anything. In those days, that could get you taken off the air.
Right. Mm-hmm. How did you get to Nashville? Did you have any kind of contract when you got there, or just hoping for the best?
Well, I'll tell you, I was here. I was in Nashville about 8 months before I came here to record, and it's a strange thing, I couldn't get in any door. Nobody knew me, and nobody wanted to know me, I guess. And then 6 months later, when they, quote-unquote, discovered me, everybody wanted me, and I was the talk of the town, when I came to record. And they all loved my music, and they, it was just that type of a thing.
So what was the moment in which you were discovered?
Well, Bobby Bear is one of the great country singers of all time. And he came through Phoenix, and he came over to this club where I was working and just flipped out. He heard, we had our own sound, and I was telling you a while ago, I had my own way of doing songs and own rhythms, and I could sing, a lot of that helps. Well, he's playing there in Nashville, in Phoenix, and then he's going from there to Vegas. Well, the next day when he left to Vegas, he stopped at every phone booth he saw, and he hounded Chet Atkins, saying, "You got to sign this guy." I said, "This guy deserves to be on a major label." Finally, Chet called me to get Bobby Bear to shut up, and said he's so laid back and everything. He said, "We'd like to have you with RCA." He said, "I like what you do." He had heard some of my demos and whatever. And he said, "Would you like to sign with us?" And, of course, that's the right hand of God is Chet Atkins. And so I signed with him, and that was it. Chet signed me without ever seeing me. You can't do that nowadays.
Why don't we hear one of the records that Chet Atkins produced of yours? And this was also your first single to reach number one on the country charts, recorded in 1968. This is "Only Daddy That'll Walk the Line." Do you want to say anything about this?
Yeah, that song, Chet is all over that. Wayne Moss is playing the guitar on it, and the band is wonderful. And this song was out by someone else. And I said, "Well, I'd love to do that, but I'm going to give him a chance." So I waited 6 months, and then he re-released it. And I had to wait another 6 months to do it because I wasn't going to cover him.
Everybody knows you've been stepping on my toes, and I'm getting pretty tired of it. You keep a stepping out of line and a messing with my mind. If you had any sense, you'd quit. 'Cause ever since you were a little bitty teeny girl, said I was the only man in this whole world. Now you better do some thinking, then you'll find you got the only daddy that'll walk the line. I keep a working every day, all you wanna do is play. I'm tired of staying out all night. I'm a coming unglued for
from your funny little moves. Now, honey, baby, that ain't right. Cause ever since you were a little bitty teeny girl, you said I was the only man in this whole world. Now you better do some thinking, then you'll find you got the only daddy that'll walk the line.
So my guest Waylon Jennings recorded in 1968. He has a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Waylon Jennings, he has a new autobiography and a new CD. Would you describe what Music Row in Nashville was like when you first settled in there?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a combination of cliques. And that's not bad. There's a bunch of good old boys over here and a bunch of good old boys and girls over there. But they didn't just let you in, you know. And they didn't. The musicians I brought with me from Phoenix, including my own brother. And I couldn't figure out why they wouldn't talk to them and why they didn't. I could tell they didn't like it because they were there. And so I asked them, what's the deal here? And they said, well, you don't bring your own cliques to Nashville. And you don't bring your musicians down on Music Row. They had the attitude that if you play the road, play the road, and if you're going to be in town, you be in town. And, of course, that went over real well with me. I said, these people have been, they've been hungry with me, and we've been together, and we're in this for the long run. And if they're not welcome, then I'm not.
And then what happened?
Well, there's a few changes made, you know. I kind of convinced them they were wrong, you know, that you don't do that.
In your book, you write, the more your records sold, the further they receded from what you had in mind, the sound you wanted to hear. What did you want, and what did you feel you were getting instead?
I wanted to recognize a record. I would do a tracks, and I'd come back, and they had put horns and all kinds of things on it. This was when Danny Davis started producing me. Chet was trying to get away from producing and more back into his own artistry. And playing guitar more. And he put me with Danny Davis, and he was just overworked. But anyway, what I wanted to hear was what I was feeling and what I had in mind. It's kind of like a painting. I don't know, it sounds corny, I guess, but to me it was. I could write a song or find a song I like, and I could describe to you what it was going to sound like when I got through. And I got into a position where it didn't. And that's very frustrating and drive you crazy. And finally, that's when it all came down. I had a meeting with them, and I had gone to L.A. to cut a record. And I didn't know they didn't want a hit coming out of L.A., a country music hit with a country artist. They wanted them all cut here. I had cut Loving Her Was Easier, which I was the first one to do that. And all of the critics and Bob Hilburn and all of them were just raving about that record. And it could have been a big hit record, but they wouldn't release it. And that's when I had, they told me, said, well, we think it's pretty good. And I said, pretty good? What do you mean, pretty good? It's great. And I said, you know what? You people don't realize it, but I am almost a legend and I've never been a hit yet.
Now, I want to just take a little sidestep here into a tangent. I can't remember who was producing the session. It might have been Herb Alpert, where you decided that you just couldn't stand pickup notes. you took a gun and said what?
I took it in the studio, but it was, I think at on that session, I think that was... I'm not sure. Anyway, Danny Davis. And that was after Herb Alpert. Herb Alpert would have thrown something at me. But I did go in there. And what had happened is I'd loaned Harlan Howard.
The songwriter.
My gun. It was a bunt line. He took it out in his fishing boat. And Merle Haggard wound up with it somehow, and he brought it back to me. And so I just put on the holster, you know, I still got it and everything, and put it on. And I went in there, and I thought, well, and there were some British journalists were in there in the studio, in the little studio there at RCA. I walked in, and I said, now, the first guy that I hear use a pickup note, I'm going to shoot his fingers off. And the guy that's sitting there looking at those numbers on that paper, after the third rundown, I'm going to just kill him. Anyway, later on, I met John Lennon. And we were cutting up and everything at one of the Grammy things. And I said, man, you're funny. I didn't know you were funny. I said, I thought you were some kind of mad guy or something like that. And he said, me? He said, listen, people in England think you shoot folks.
No, explain for people who don't know written music what pickup notes are, and then tell us why you're so opposed to them.
Well, you know, it gives it away. You know, it goes, dun, 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 you know, like, and there you know, why not just keep it rolling and rolling and having a good time and then come in where you're supposed to. And you haven't given everything away. You know, that's what pickup notes do. And it's the easy way, too, because it keeps, you know, you don't have to pay that much attention when you hear a pickup note coming. You know, you got to change keys.
So it's just all becoming formula to you.
It was all formula. It was like cookie cutters. You know, everything you did. And here these guys playing four sessions a day sometime. How creative can you be? You know? And they wouldn't let you use your own band. They didn't want you to use your... I'm not saying one thing bad about the musicians here. They're the greatest musicians in the world because, they had that number system, and for that music, it was wonderful. I just didn't like, you know, pickup notes, like I said. It's like, doom, 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 doom. Oh, I'm a good guy, doom, 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 doom. That was it.
Waylon Jennings has a new autobiography and a new CD. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Some have said down through history, if you last, it's a mystery, but I guess they don't know what they're talking about. From the mountains down to the sea, you've become such a habit with me. America, America.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Waylon Jennings. He'll tell us how he developed the outlaw image. And linguist Jeff Nunberg looks at the meaning of the word rich in this election year.
I've been quite the traveler ever since I hit the road. And the Sullivan County Carnival has been my earn and go. I've been quite alone since I remember when I turned my ultimatums into chips and cashed them in. I used to run the Ferris wheel, but that'd be hard to prove. I can't stand to see a rolling wheel propped up so it can't move. used to run the carousel. Hell, that's just round and round. I never liked to see them ponies painted up and bolted down. The only thing that keeps me from staying here is leaving. The only thing that saves me from it all.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with country music star Waylon Jennings. His autobiography, Waylon, has just been published, and he has a new CD called Right for the Time. Jennings was one of the creators of the outlaw movement in country music in the 1970s. In 1973, you collaborated with the songwriter Billy Joe Shaver and put out an album that really established your image as the outlaw in country music. And tell me about how you started working with Billy Joe Shaver and how you think this collaboration changed your image.
Well, I don't know what it did to my image. I think it changed music. I think it changed country music. I got my freedom and got the right to produce my own things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and got Tom Paul Glazer to help me with that. And some of those tracks on there are only three instruments and me singing, which was unheard of in those days. You know, they thought that was a demo. But I was looking for the feeling, not necessarily the full tracks. But I met Billy Joe through Bobby Bear. He had brought him to town, was publishing his things, and had done several of his things. And Chris Christopherson had heard a couple of things and maybe recorded a couple of his songs. And so I called Bobby and I said, "Has he got any more songs? Because they were great." He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Listen, send me everything he's got over here." So I got to listening to it and I said, "I'm going to do an album of his songs, all of them." So I told Billy, I said, "I'm going to do that, but I said, it's going to be a little while before I do it." And then Billy got all excited, even threatened to whip me one time if I didn't hurry up and do his album. Because, I mean, he was right out of Waco, Texas, and what I call 1960 Waco. But Billy Joe was a great writer, and he hit it right on the nail, right on the head. And it was, the lyrics and everything were so great. And it changed. That record changed the music industry.
Let me play one of the best-known songs from your album of songs by Billy Joe Shaver. This is Honky Tonk Heroes, recorded in 1973. This version of it starts off with a classic country arrangement and then kind of shifts into a much more rock arrangement. Was that your idea to do it that way?
Yeah, and that's what almost got me and Billy Joe in a hassle. He couldn't tell what I was doing with it. He said, "What you doing to my song?" And I said, "Got a deal for you. You get out of here." And I said, "When I get through with it, you come listen to it. If you don't like it, I'll change it, or I won't even do it, okay?" Anyway, I said, "Either way, you win."
And what did he think when it was done?
He loved it, yeah.
Why don't we hear it?
Piano road blues, danced holes in my shoes. There weren't another way to be. For lovable losers, no account losers. And honky tonk heroes like me. Hey, hey. Where does it go? The good Lord only knows. Seemed like it was just the other day. I was down in Green Gables, a hogging them tables, and generally blowing all of my heart. Loser and no
Waylon Jennings recorded in 1973. Now he has a new autobiography and also a new CD called Right for the Time. How did the Outlaw name come about?
I had an album on RCA, and it was called Ladies Love Outlaws, which was after a song, you know, and they kind of picked it up there. And then when in search of something, they called me everything for a long time. They called me Outlaw. They called me Rebel. They didn't know quite what pocket to put me in. But that's where it started originally. And then when they decided to put out the album with me and Tom, Paul, Jesse, and Willie, they used it there, and it kind of caught on.
That's the album Wanted, the Outlaws, which was the first country album to sell a million, I think.
It was, yeah.
Now, you and Willie Nelson combined country music and, part of the hippie world, long hair and blue jeans.
Wasn't we cute? We were cute.
You think of it that way at the time, that you were, you know, bridging two worlds that normally weren't coming together?
No, you know, what we did, and it wasn't something that intentionally destroyed what Nashville had going, but we realized that we were not going to be accepted on their terms, and because we couldn't be that. You know, and I didn't want to wear no Spanglish suits, although I thought some of the guys looked good in them, you know. When I was growing up, I loved them. But you know what? I didn't want to wear that. And Willie didn't want to wear it either. And we wanted to play our own music. We didn't want, you know, the sock rhythms. And we had guys that played our music the way we wanted it. But we saw that we were not going to fit, and that was it. Willie moved to Texas, but I stayed in Nashville. But I realized, you know, I mean, like, we were outsiders. And then all of a sudden, we sold a lot of records. And they just went nuts. And we were their fair-haired children, but it was too late. We kind of ignored all of that. And they were telling us how wonderful, and they were with us all the way and knew it all along it was going to happen. And so, but we paid. We just did what we wanted to, because you know what? When they were in control of us and of our lives, they did what they wanted to. You know, it wasn't get even time or anything like that. We just, I guess we looked like hippies. Well, I know we did. You know, I mean, cowboy hippies anyway. And then all of a sudden, we were drawing 70,000 or 200,000 young people, along with the others. And it worked. That was it.
So suddenly, I guess everybody wanted to be an outlaw, huh?
I guess. Yeah, I guess so.
My guest is Waylon Jennings. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Waylon Jennings. He has a new autobiography and a new CD. Why don't I play one of the recordings featured on the Wanted the Outlaws album that you did with Willie Nelson, Jesse Coulter. This is something you co-wrote with Willie Nelson, and you both sing on it. And it's A Good-Hearted Woman, which you also recorded on your own. Tell me about this particular track.
That song, Willie and I wrote that while we were playing poker one time in a hotel with Billy Gray and Paul English.
Wait, you were playing poker with Billy Graham?
Billy Gray.
Oh. I thought that sounded improbable.
Billy Graham cheats. We don't let him play no more. But anyway, and so I was recording the next day, and I said, Willie, I like two lines in this song. You help me get them, and I'll give you half this song. So we did, but we wrote it while we was playing poker. Now, we lost our rears in that poker game, but we got a pretty good song.
Why don't we hear A Good-Hearted Woman? This is Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson.
He likes the bright lights and nightlife and good time friends. And when the party's all over, she'll welcome him back home again. Lord knows she don't understand him, but she does the best that she can. Now this a good-hearted woman, loving a good-time man. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-time man. She loves me in spite of my wicked ways that she don't understand. Through teardrops and laughter, the past of this world hand in hand. A good-hearted woman, loving a good-timing man.
My guest, Waylon Jennings, with Willie Nelson, one of the tracks featured on their album, Wanted, The Outlaws. There was a rather long period in your life where you went through a lot of coke and pills and women and had guns. And I think it was, well, I can't remember exactly when it was that you gave up drugs, and you say it took 8 years after that before you wrote a song or before you were able to be on stage and feel like you weren't boring people sick. 8 years to figure out who you were again. What did it take to figure out who you were again after giving up drugs? I mean, if you could describe what the confusion or disorientation was like when you gave up drugs and you were straight.
You know, as corny as it sounds, it's like it's another person. And he's very real. And everything you do when you're on cocaine, you can blame it on him. You know, it's like you're still sitting over here and you're a good guy. And when you quit, you actually mourn for that person because that person dies. And that's the best way I know how to describe it, because there you are, you know, and you're alone again. When you go into a room, you don't know how you're supposed to act or what people or who people think you are, you know. And they cause a little of it, too, because they wonder. It's like one of the guys that worked with me when I quit drugs. They said he was paranoid anyway, but he said he asked the Jerry Bridges that plays bass with me at that time, says, "Have you seen Waylon since he's been off drugs?" And he said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, what do you think? You think he'll like me still?" And he says, "I don't know. I'll ask him." But it's kind of like that. They don't know. And then you have these people. A lot of people have written things like, "I liked him better when he was on drugs." That don't help a lot. But I didn't write for a long time. And because with drugs, the big addiction is you don't think you can do anything without them. And you have people telling you that you're much better when you're on drugs. But it took, it, like I say, about 8 years, and I started writing again. I got to some of the writers here in town, Troy Seals and Roger Murrow. And I got to co-writing because most of my writing had been done by myself. And I got to writing songs and with them, and that helped that. And then my wife, Jessie, helped me through a lot of the rest of it. Every once in a while I'd say, "Boy, I wish I had some cocaine." And she knew exactly what I was doing. Just when you think of it, say it. Last 7 seconds.
So when was it that you actually gave up drugs?
84. It was March the 30th. I tried to do all I had with me, and I couldn't. And so I just on the 29th, I quit when I threw the bottle away. And on the 30th, it was from that day on, I never did any drugs at all.
You say when you gave up drugs, you probably doubled or tripled the number of cigarettes that you were smoking.
Yeah.
Which isn't a very good thing for a smoker in particular, for a singer in particular. How did it affect your voice to be smoking so much? And do you still smoke?
No, I quit smoking in 88. I was up to 6 or 7 packs a day sometimes.
Wow. That's a lot.
I just smoke. Well,
you
when I was
probably
on
have
drugs,
to smoke through the night to do that much.
No, not really.
No?
Just don't ever, just light one off the other. But when I was on drugs, I smoked constantly, and I stayed up for 5 and 6 days and nights at a time. So that was pretty easy to smoke that much. But I have, you know, like stayed up all those hours and everything, smoked all those cigarettes, and my voice has stuck with me somehow. It got to getting pretty bad at the end there, but it wasn't. But it stuck with me pretty good.
Waylon Jennings, I understand that you and Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, I mean, together you're the Highwaymen. Separately, I understand you have trouble getting played on country music stations now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do that, yeah. The young country and new country. We still get, see, that's 400 stations, and they're the ones who report. Now, I haven't had a chart record in about, I guess, 3 or 4 years. And every year my price goes up, and I could work 3 times as much. Because we still draw people.
At concerts.
The people are what counts.
Now, are those people who don't buy records? Or, I mean, do executives...
We don't have to sell records. Do you know that?
Right.
You know, they take... I feel sorry for the new artists, the ones that are getting played. They take them on there and burn them out. And then they want to see, they'll say, well, like Randy Travis, you know, when they burned him out for a while. And then they said, well, we need a new Randy Travis. And somebody said, well, what's wrong with the one you got, you know? But it's not like that. The whole thing is they take them in and say, okay, you're going to be in here, you're going to be out of here in about 4 years. You better make the best of it. Now, here they go, telling them what to wear, telling them what hat to wear, and just trying to get rich as fast as they can out of it. And here these guys who really care about their music, it's not like, but there'll be a guy come along and bust their bubble. He will. We did. I did when I refused to work in their studios and let them tell me how to do my music.
I guess in some ways you might feel like you're in the position now that you were in earlier in your career in country music, being at odds with the industry?
You know what? I wouldn't have it any other way. I really wouldn't. Every once in a while I cut an album when I want to, and right now I'm with Justice Records, and Randall Jamal, you know, he came to me and he said, I'm not in the record business, I'm in the music business. And what if when you decide you want to do something, anything you want to do is what we'll do. And that's all I need, because, you know, as far as the charts are selling the big bunches of records, I sold a bunch of records at one time, you know, and I wouldn't take for that time, but I don't want it again. If they told me you can be the king of the world tomorrow, as far as music is concerned, I'd say no. I really would, because I'm happy. I'm doing what I want to, and I'll never let them get that control back.
Tell us something about your approach to your new CD, choosing the songs, the arrangements.
I'll tell you a secret about that. You know, I was very sick when I was doing that. I was taking a medicine for, I'm a diabetic, and it was rough, really, really rough, because I didn't feel good ever. But Randall understood that, and the approach we had was like, let it flow, just let it go. We kind of wanted to get back and get some of that old edge that we had, and the simplicity of the music where the song came through.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, I've enjoyed it. I really have. You got some good questions there, girl.
Oh, thank you. Waylon Jennings' new autobiography is called Waylon. His new CD is called Right for the Time. This is the title track, which he composed.
almost out of bad lessons and into a world we didn't know. Not necessarily love, but in trouble with the fire down below. Looking back for a feeling, it's just something far away and long ago. I can still recall the name, but she's really someone I don't even know. But she was right for the time. She was right for the time, but time has a way of moving on.
Waylon Jennings from his new CD, Right for the Time. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the changing meaning of the word rich in this presidential election year. This is Fresh Air. Forbes magazine has just released its annual list of the 400 richest Americans. This year, the cutoff point has gone up to over 400 million, a jump of 75 million from the year before. Yet the growing disparities of income in America haven't figured much in the presidential campaign. In fact, as linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, the word rich has scarcely been mentioned.
There was a Gallup survey a couple of years ago that asked people to estimate what proportion of Americans were rich. The average answer was 21%. But when the survey asked people to rank their own place on the income scale, only 6 people out of the 1,200 surveyed were willing to describe themselves as rich. That's exactly 0.5%. And if you assume that this sample group was representative, you'll conclude that there are a lot of people making more than $1 million a year who don't think of themselves as rich at all. Of course, it's true that people at the top of the income scale tend to be underrepresented on telephone surveys like this one. Whether or not you agree with F. Scott Fitzgerald that the rich are different from you and me, they're for sure a lot harder to get hold of. Still, what surprises me is not that the survey found only a handful of people who were willing to describe themselves as rich, but that they found anybody at all. My own guess is that if you pulled most of the people on the Forbes list aside and asked them confidentially whether they consider themselves rich, they wouldn't exactly say no, but they'd try to rephrase the question. I'm comfortable, they'd say, or, well, I suppose I've done well for myself. In fact, the only person in the Forbes 400 who I was absolutely sure would have no reservations about calling herself rich was Oprah Winfrey, who snuck into the very last spot with $415 million. Or at least, if Oprah doesn't like being called rich, she'd keep quiet about it on national television. Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin has no such compunctions. Bob Woodward relates in his book The Agenda that a couple of years ago, the Wall Street millionaire Rubin told President Clinton that he hated it when Clinton used the word rich. If Clinton must talk about people with money, let him say the well-to-do. And Clinton seems to have taken Rubin's suggestion to heart. Old-style Democrats like Jesse Jackson, Mario Cuomo, and Teddy Kennedy have no trouble talking about the rich. And even Bob Dole can charge that Clintonomics has left the poor poorer and the rich richer. Though, of course, Dole doesn't have to worry that the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal is going to charge him with fanning the fires of class envy. But references to the rich were conspicuously absent from Clinton's convention speech last month, as well as from the speeches of Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, Evan Bay, and Christopher Dodd. That's what makes the New Democrats different from everybody else, is that they avoid the R word. The word rich goes back to the Indo-European name for a tribal king, and in a way, it's never lost the implication of a society divided into two estates. Of all the words for people who have money, well-to-do, wealthy, affluent, it's the only one that comes with an opposite term. And it's the only one of them that suggests a qualitative distinction, too. Wealthy and affluent are just matters of degree. And well-to-do just means that you have the kind of money that makes you respectable. Bankers and lawyers are well-to-do, not Mike Tyson or Roseanne Barr. But rich implies not just having a lot of money, but having more of it than you need. There's a sense of overabundance and superfluity that runs through all the uses of the word, whether we're talking about people or pastries. And with rich, there's the implication, too, that too much money can overwhelm your moral sense, in just the way that too much butter and cream can overwhelm your sense of taste. Filthy rich, we say, which is not at all the same as dirt poor. I can see why Rubin and his set would bridle at the word, with its implication that they might be excessively compensated for their pains. Nobody likes to think that, which is why rich is an adjective we only use in the third person. Still, sometimes it's useful to calibrate our own self-assessments with the opinions of others. I was talking to a Stanford colleague the other day who does research in a school in a poor part of San Jose. One of the third graders there asked her if she was rich. Well, she said, my husband and I both have good jobs. And the kid said, you're rich. The only difference between her and Robert Rubin is that she had the tact not to deny it.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. He's the editor of a new collection of essays called The Future of the Book, published by the University of California Press. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll hear from the director of the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, a filmed concert held 28 years ago in a TV studio featuring the Stones, John Lennon, and others. The Stones didn't like their performance, so the film was never produced until now. And now it offers the chance to see the Rolling Stones of an earlier era in a stripped-down, comparatively intimate setting. We'll hear the story tomorrow. We'll close today's show with music from the film released on a companion CD. This is You Can't Always Get What You Want.
I saw her today at the reception. A glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. And I said that you can't always get what you want, honey. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometime, well, you might just find that you're what you need. Ah, yeah, yeah. So I went to the Chelsea drugstore to get your prescription filled. I was standing in line with your friend Jimmy.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. It was filmed 28 years ago, but Mick Jagger wasn't happy with his performance, so it wasn't made into a movie. In the 80s, the footage was rediscovered, and it's since been edited. We'll talk with director Michael Lindsay Hogg. Join us for the next Fresh Air.